You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Coming up on our program today, well, Steve Israel is going to be with us, the chairman of the DCCC. Peter Ferrara is going to drop by. That should be entertaining, to say the very least. And at some length, actually, at some considerable length, in our third hour today, I want to offer a suggestion, a solution, actually, to the unemployment problem, something that actually another country, France, has done, is doing again, has worked quite successfully, and could literally end unemployment. I mean, reduce the unemployment rate down to a functional zero here in the United States. It wouldn't be very complicated. We'll get into all of that in our third hour. I'd like to kick off, though, with the remnants of slavery. I find this fascinating. Thomas Jefferson, you go over to the Jefferson Memorial, you can read clips of a letter that he wrote in later in his life, in which he was basically predicting the Civil War and was talking about the horrors that America, having had slavery, would visit upon its children and upon its country. In fact, he even made the comment that, you know, my only consolation is that I shall not live to shed tears over this. So who would have thought that slavery 200 years ago would help Republicans today? But it's happening. America is awash with the horrible legacies of slavery. The obvious ones are centuries of racial discrimination and its consequences today in wealth and opportunity disparities between the races. Less obvious, though, is what's left over from that huge debate during the Constitutional Convention of 1787 about who should vote. They ended up not deciding that. The issue of women voting never came up. In several states, women could vote. New Jersey gave women the right to vote from the time of the Constitutional Convention, you know, at 1787, full ratification 1789, right up until 1807. Women were voting in New Jersey. And in 1870, with the passage of the 14th Amendment, the word male was inserted into the U.S. Constitution, and as Elizabeth Cady Stanton predicted at the time, it took generations to get it back out. Similarly, at the time the Constitution was being debated, we were operating under the Articles of Confederation, and only 10 of the 13 states, or fully 10 of the 13 states, had laws that only allowed people who either owned land, paid taxes, or both, to vote. And, of course, the southern states wanted to make sure that their slaves didn't get the right to vote. So because various states wanted to be able to prevent various people from voting for various reasons, one of the most important things that should be in our Constitution, the affirmative right to vote, was never included. In fact, the Supreme Court has even said they said it in Bush v. Gore, there is no affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. Because of this, because we don't have a right to vote guaranteed by our Constitution, the core Republican strategy ever since LBJ signed the Voting Rights Act has been Nixon's Southern strategy. Prey on racist fears to get fearful white people to the polls while limiting the number of people of color who can vote. Paul Weyrich, I'm going to play this clip here, Shane, if you've got that. It's Paul Weyrich said back in 1980 when he was helping run the Reagan campaign and founding ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, Republicans explicitly don't want people who are not upper-income white Christians to vote. Here he is.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
Now, this is the guy who founded ALEC. The Republican Party has been really good to upper-middle-class white people who have a job, and only 8% of all the white people in our country over the age of 21 don't have an ID that they can use to vote. And odds are most of that 8%, It's mostly poor white people who are very often not Republican voters anyway. So having ID is not an issue for Republican voters. So how do Republicans put into law Paul Weyrich's declaration that they don't want people to vote? It's easy. You have the organization that Weyrich founded, ALEC, write voter ID laws and have those laws introduced in every state in the union, and where they pass, people without narrowly defined specific IDs won't be able to vote. That particularly includes Americans who don't drive, either because they live in cities with good public transportation, or they're too poor to afford a car, or they're going to college and live on campus, or are elderly and have lost their ability to drive. That may sound like a small group, people who don't drive, but here are the numbers of the people that these ALEC-written laws would kick off the voting rolls. Fully a quarter of all African Americans eligible to vote don't have the kind of ID that Paul Weyrich's ALEC would require. 19% of Latinos, 18% of young people of college age, 18% of seniors on Social Security, and 15% of low-income whites don't have IDs. These groups make up one of the primary core Democratic constituencies. The other, of course, is union workers. So, of course, Republicans would work to eliminate the right to vote, just like they're trying to eliminate the right of union workers to have unions. And the only reason Republicans can pull this off is because there's no statement in our Constitution that says that voting is a right and not a privilege. And the Republicans are so proud of it that the guy the Republican governor of Pennsylvania hired to let the state citizen, let that state's, you know, Pennsylvania citizens know about Pennsylvania's new voter ID law, he's a bundler for Mitt Romney. It's like they're robbing us of our votes and then putting a robber in charge of the court. If we passed a constitutional amendment that said something very simple, voting is a right, not a privilege. If we simply did that, Republicans could no longer limit the right to vote. Similarly, voting machines that put our vote into the hands of unaccountable corporations operating in secret would end if we had an affirmative right to vote. Meanwhile, Republicans are working hard to get their own middle-class white voters out to show up at the polls. They have a small problem with this group in that Mitt Romney isn't exactly an inspiring candidate, and many of these Republican voters consider themselves Christians, and so they're suspicious of Romney's Mormonism. So they need a front group who the Christian Republicans trust. And who's that group? Who's that guy? Well, it turns out it's Ralph Reed. Remember Ralph Reed? Ralph Reed is this guy. He's 50 or 51 years old, but he looks like he's 25. He was called the Wunderkind and all this kind of stuff. He was back with Moral Majority and everything else. In fact, I think he was one of the co-founders of it. But he got caught up in the middle of this Jack Abramoff scandal. In fact, while Bob Ney was the guy who went to jail in that thing and Jack Abramoff, Ralph Reed was really very much in the center of it. I'm just astounded that he didn't end up going to prison. And now he's been rehabilitated. And so Ralph Reed is going to be, you know, running around telling the Republican base that they've got to get out to vote. So that basically the Republicans have this two-prong strategy. One prong is suppress the Democratic vote. And the other prong is get out the Republican vote. To suppress the Democratic vote, they're saying that, you know, you can't vote unless you got a very specific ID that typically comes with being the driver of a car, the owner of a car. So it's sort of like the old, you know, the old requirement that you had to own land. Well, now you've got to own a car, have a driver's license in order to vote. So that's how they suppress the Democratic vote, or at least a portion of it. And then Ralph Reed's out there getting out the Republicans.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So the question, how much longer are we going to let this stuff continue? The DCCC is raising some noise about it. We'll see where that goes. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Steve Israel, the Democrat, one of the Democrats in the House of Representatives, so capably representing the great state of New York, and the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee on the line with us. Sir, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you, as always, Tom.
It's been a while. What's the DCCC up to in this election cycle? What are you guys doing?
Oh, we are aggressive and we are on offense. We're holding Republicans accountable for their absolute wrong priorities, their attempts, reckless attempts to undermine the middle class. And there could be no better demonstration of that than what they're going to do tomorrow. You know, we want to move forward to vote on comprehensive legislation to create jobs. They want to move backwards and repeal patient protections and actually hurt the middle class.
We're
accountable with all the tools in our toolbox.
Yeah, this astounds me. One of the things that astounds me is that nobody has run an ad that simply says, Obamacare, what's in it? And then goes through a short list to educate Americans. But the Republicans think that there's some political gain in repealing the Affordable Care Act, or a.k.a. Obamacare. And won't this help you guys to amplify the message, to explain to Americans what's actually in that law that the Republicans are going to be voting against?
I think it helps immeasurably. And we are actually doing ads. We're doing robocalls. We're doing web ads. We're doing billboards. We're doing everything we can to tell people that tomorrow the House Republicans will, for the 31st time, attempt to take away a woman's right to health insurance if she has breast cancer. Go back to the days when her insurance company can say, your breast cancer is too expensive. Tomorrow, they're going to kick children up to the age of 26 off their parents' health insurance plans. Tomorrow, they're going to tell seniors that they have to pay more for their prescription drugs by reimposing the donut hole. Tomorrow, they're going to repeal patient protections, like telling insurance companies that they can't impose lifetime caps and limits on what they pay for critical health care. The Republicans are going to take all of those things away from America's middle class. And when we tell the middle class what Republicans are trying to do and how reckless and ideological they are, the middle class has buyer's remorse about the Republican that they may have elected in the last election.
Yeah, this is truly astounding. And hopefully it will wake up a number of people. When the Republicans voted in the House of Representatives to replace Medicare with a voucher program, mm-hmm. there was, as I recall, seven Republicans who didn't go along with that. There's just a very, very tiny handful.
Mm-hmm.
Are you expecting the same kind of vote, that this is basically going to be unanimous? All the Republicans in the House of Representatives are going to vote to say, you know, sorry, the health insurance companies are no longer constrained to, they no longer have to spend 80% of the money they take in on health care.
Right.
They can now just spend 50% and the CEO can take a bigger bonus.
Well, I'll tell you what, I just came off the floor. We just had a series of votes, and the literal hand few of moderate Republicans that are left on the floor have told me that there's increased jitteriness in their caucus about taking this vote tomorrow and then having to go home to their districts, to a town meeting, and explain why they repealed these important patient protections and why they are putting the profits of insurance companies ahead of the stability of the middle class. They are defending the indefensible. And so I think that they're going to have some real cracks in their ranks. Now, if you're a Republican, you have that ironclad discipline where you're willing to put insurance company profits ahead of your own constituents and put your party leadership ahead of your own district. So maybe they will close ranks tomorrow. But I'll tell you, they are very nervous going into this vote.
Well, if they are going to close ranks and if they are going to do this, knowing, you know, basically that they're handing you guys campaign ads in the fall, they have to be doing it assuming that the billionaires and the large corporations, including large transnational and foreign corporations that are so heavily funding these third-party attack groups that are working on behalf of Republican candidates or to help Republicans, however you want to say it, however you correctly say that, that they're just going to be able to win the money game.
Yep. Well, that's just it. I mean, look. You have from day one, the House Republican majority has protected millionaires and billionaires, and now the House Republican majority is counting on millionaires and billionaires to protect them in this election. So they think that they can do this with impunity. They can hurt the middle class, stand up for insurance company profits, and rely on Karl Rove and the Koch brothers to come to their rescue in this election. And we cannot let them get away with it. I'll tell you the best antidote to those super PACs. People should go to DCCC.org. And take a look at the robocalls we're doing and take a look at the web ads we're doing and support our grassroots fight to take this house back and protect health care, protect Medicare, and protect the middle class. DCCC.org, if I can get that commercial in.
Yes, please. And in fact, my apologies for not doing it in the setup in the opening here. DCCC, DCCC.org
yes,
is the website for the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And Steve Israel is its chairman. He's on the line with us. And anything, I mean, it's just, when you think about the enormous amount of work that you all did when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, several hundred bills that actually would have brought jobs back from overseas, that would have made the tax laws more rational and fairer, that would have provided, you know, genuine benefits to working people. Virtually all of them got a majority in the Senate, and yet they were blocked by Republicans, by a small minority of Republicans from, in many cases, some very, very small states, population-wise. What can we expect, Congressman Israel, in the minute we have left here, what can we expect if the Democrats fail to take back the House?
Well, I think it'll get even worse, because I think that as extreme and as excessive as the House Republicans have been, since they took the majority, if they win the majority, if they keep the majority this November, they will feel validated and vindicated, and they will double down. And so the Ryan budget will look like, a game compared to what they do. Mm. They started their majority by ending Medicare. They want to end their majority by ending patient protections for the middle class. And this is when they know the House is in play. Imagine what they'll do if they feel validated and vindicated by the November elections. We cannot let them get away with it. We got to fight back.
Yeah, and if you want to fight back, you can go to DCCC.org and help out and see what's going on there. Pass it along, share it with your friends, all those kind of things. Congressman Steve Israel, chairman of the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. You got a big job ahead of you, sir. I wish you the best.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks. Good talking with you. We will be back. It is 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Stick around. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So have you had any experience with these phony baloney voter IDs or real voter, whatever you call them, and these voter ID laws? Give me a shout. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, this was ratified on January 23rd, 1964. Just consider that. 1964. It was proposed 2 years earlier in the summer of 1962, August 27, 1962. It is the 24th Amendment. The 24th Amendment to the United States Constitution says the right of citizens to the United States to vote in any primary or other election for president or vice president or electors for president or vice president or for senator or representative in Congress shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or any state by reason of failure to pay any poll tax or other tax. Now, see, I personally think they should have gone a step farther and said, it is the right of all citizens in the United States to vote. And then follow that with Congress shall have the power to enforce that article with appropriate legislation. But instead they said, you can't have a poll tax. Well, Eric Holder just gave a speech to the 104th Annual Convention of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP. And Eric Holder, the first African-American attorney general in the history of the United States, went off his script. And this is making some very big news. His prepared remarks, his transcript, whatever was in his prompter, did not mention poll taxes. But he was talking about these voter ID laws that have been promoted by Paul Weyrich's ALEC organization, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which Paul Weyrich started back in the late 70s, early 80s, and has written these laws, pushed them into all the states. Koch brothers funding it very heavily. And he pointed out that among white Americans, only 8% of white Americans don't have ID. And presumably also probably don't vote. Among African Americans, it's a quarter. 25% of African Americans of voting age don't have the kind of ID necessary to vote. They don't have a driver's license. They don't have a passport. And then he went off his prepared remarks. He said, this is a poll tax. The crowd went nuts. But now, the Attorney General of the United States is on record as saying the Republicans at, you know, a dozen or more Republican states that's been introduced into 25 different states have passed laws that are violations of the Constitution. He called it a poll tax. I think he's right. I think it is a poll tax. But now is the Justice Department going to take, you know, the full force of the Justice Department on this thing against the states? This is going to be very interesting. Keep an eye on this. Liz in Fort Lauderdale. Hey, Liz, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I was one of the people in Florida that purged off the rolls, and I only had a certain amount of time to get all my paperwork and everything together, and of course it was right around my birthday, so it was not fun, and I was really upset.
So you got one of these letters saying that if you don't respond within 30 days, I think it was down in Florida, if you don't respond within a certain period of time, you will be taken off the voter rolls.
I was told that I was going to receive one of those letters because it was my birthday and I was renewing my license. And I just, you know, I couldn't believe what they were telling me. And, you know, nonetheless, I had a terrible birthday.
Yeah.
But... you know, I'm just sitting there thinking to myself, looking around, seeing everyone out there going through the same thing. I mean, is this America anymore? I mean,
well, by and large, the Republicans, the Republicans, and thank you, Liz, for the call. The Republicans want to take it back to the America that we had in the late 19th century. I mean, they want to literally they want to do that. They want to do away with Social Security, which came about in the 1930s. They've already done away with the banking regulations, the, you know, Glass-Steagall 1935. They want to take us back to the late 1800s, the late 19th century. And when there was a poll tax, when if you wanted to vote, you had to pay a tax. And rich people could afford the tax. By and large, white people could afford the tax. By and large, poor people, particularly African Americans, couldn't afford the tax. Or literacy tests, things like this. I mean, it just went on and on. This was, and in fact, it was in 1964 that they amended the Constitution to take this thing out. Ron in Houston, Texas. Hey, Ron, what's up?
Yes, sir. Of course, Texas is in court this very day in Washington.
Indeed, it is.
We should have ID. But a couple of things on it. One, for a driver's license in Texas, even if you don't have a car, you still have to have liability insurance, about $600 a year.
Oh, really?
And yes, you have to have liability if you have a driver's license. So that eliminates a lot of students who don't drive or older people who say, well, I don't need to drive anymore, so they get rid of theirs.
Right.
Also, in cities like Houston, very few driver's license offices, normally a 4 to 6 hour wait to get your license renewed or to get one. And quite often they'll have you come in one day to make an appointment and come back another day to do it.
Right.
They're only open 8 to 5, except one day a week they're open till 7. So it can be very difficult, especially for older people, to go in and renew an ID.
Or for people who if they take even one day off work, they're going to get fired or they're going to lose a chunk of their pay that equals whether or not they're going to feed their kids that week.
Plus, one little curiosity I wonder if the Justice Department will bring up. The state has admitted that all of the voter ID fraud cases they have pursued or actually filed on included absentee ballots, which required no ID to get one, and under the new law requires no ID to get one. And usually it was a spouse, like say an older couple, the husband died and the wife decided she was going to keep voting for her ex-husband, her late husband.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's really, like you say, it's just an intimidation to get rid of the portion of the population that the Republicans don't want risking to vote.
Yeah, it's pure and simple. This is voter suppression. Ron, thank you for bringing some more clarity to it from your position there in Texas. Joe in Chicago. Hey, Joe, what's up? Joe?
Yes.
Yeah.
I was calling because anybody that goes to an ID office in Chicago and anywhere else, if you stand around for 5 minutes, you'll see them turning around many, many people because they don't have enough credentials with them to get the ID.
Wow.
And it would be wonderful if anybody could do an investigative film or documentary showing that. And a major reason is you have to have your birth certificate. And if you're not in a region where you were born, it can take months to get your birth certificate from another state through the
mail.
And
it can be expensive.
and cost more money and more trips. But it can take several months. Sometimes it's almost impossible to get a birth certificate from a place through the mail, unless you're actually physically in that county where you were born to go get it yourself.
Right. So, and the Republicans are all counting on making things progressively harder and harder for Americans to vote, and because they know that if they can cut down on the number of people voting, there's a greater problem, and make it very easy for wealthy white people to vote, then maybe they can hold on to power for another generation. This is all about this generational change that we're watching in the United States, and it's astounding, frankly. Eugene in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Eugene, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind?
I agree with everything everybody said.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you, it's outlandish. I went down to get my driver's license in San Antonio here,
mm-hmm.
and it's a big city. It takes you from 8 o'clock in the morning to about 11 o'clock to get up through that line, almost 2.5 to 3 hours
wow.
to go through their process.
Wow.
And then if you don't have your paperwork, like you said, then you have to go back and start all over again.
Right.
It's ridiculous. And the service that we get in this country anymore is outlandish. I'm a plumber, and I work for myself, and I'm telling you, it's hard. I have people every day tell me they just don't have the money to do the work. The people are poor. The government is trying to get us to a point where we're just slave labor again.
Well, basically. Not so much the government. I would say the Republican Party. They're working at this really, really hard. Thank you, Eugene. Well said. Steve in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom, with Citizens United and the obvious voter suppression tactics of the Republican Party, this is a perfect time for the Democrats to push for not only a universal voter rights amendment, but a voter bill of rights, which would include not only that, but a national holiday for voting, a national database where voters make sure that their vote was counted, some sensible redistricting rules that the voters control.
Yeah, and requiring congressional districts to be polygons, you know.
Yeah, and maybe even an upgrade to something, a ranked voting system like instant runoff or board account.
Yeah.
Where we get to, you know, so parties don't get split by dark horses.
Yeah.
And if the Democrats do this, it'll rev up the base, and it'll make a stark contrast with the Republicans.
Now, some of those things can only be done at the state level, like, you know, for example, ranked voting or instant runoff voting. You can't do that at a federal. I mean, arguably, you could do that for electors for the president, but. I'm not even sure that you could pass a. Actually, I don't think you could pass a federal law to do that. I think it's up to the states to decide how they're going to conduct their voting. And again, this is another one of those vestiges of slavery. You know, our country was birthed in the horrors of slavery, and it's still echoing. But Steve, all of your other suggestions, absolutely brilliant, and those as well. Just that we need to, you know, that's the work for local politics. We need to get involved in local politics to bring about instant runoff voting and things like that. So, but yeah, a national holiday for the vote? I mean, really? Of course.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, you know, we take the day off to celebrate Christopher Columbus. We take the day off to celebrate Christmas? Why can't we take the day off to celebrate voting?
On Tuesday, you made me fly much higher than before.
It's about Tuesday, or is it about voting? It's just about Tuesdays, yes. Why don't we vote on Saturdays or Sundays? You know, or both? I mean, of course, that would require amending the Constitution, too. But states are doing this. And they're doing it well. Angela in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Angela, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I was watching Colbert Report last week, and they showed a video clip of the head of the PA State House who said the voter ID laws were to elect Romney. It was done.
Yes. Yeah, he actually said that. He was the Speaker of the House for the state of Pennsylvania, the Pennsylvania state representative, state legislature, House of Representatives. And he was just like going through the list of things that they needed to do to get Romney elected. And this was one of them. In fact, here's the clip right here.
Voter ID, which is going to allow Governor Romney to win the state of Pennsylvania. Done.
There you go.
Yeah.
So, and that's where you live.
And it's a funny thing is Romney doesn't even think he has a chance here.
Yeah. Well, it's over 700,000 people in the state of Pennsylvania, the vast majority of them being people who are people of color or people who are living in urban areas or people who are elderly who don't have driver's licenses, who don't have ID, they don't own cars, and they're going to lose their right to vote. So and the Republicans are all about this. They understand this.
And it's easy to slip through because they don't need Justice Department approval because they didn't act bad in the past, but boy, are they making up for this.
Yeah, and which is a shame, but frankly, if Eric Holder, and thank you for the call, Angela, if Eric Holder is going to say this is a poll tax, which he just said today, and I guarantee you that the right wing is going to be all over him. They probably are right now. I don't have a monitor up to watch Fox News, but I guarantee you if I were, they would be all. This would be wall to wall. Eric Holder, he's calling it a poll tax. Oh my goodness, how can he do that? And look at him with all those black people. I mean, there's going to be the racist undercurrent of this thing, the racist underbelly of America is, well, it'll be so on display in right wing talk radio today. And you watch, you listen. Dave in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Dave, thanks for listening to WWRL. What's up?
Okay, I got three things I'll mention fast.
Pick one.
Okay, the Democratic. I heard on a TV show on public television a couple years ago that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee does not give money to liberal candidates. And I'll say one more thing.
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. They tend to support the candidates that they think can most effectively win the district. And so there are some districts that are, you know, heavily Republican, and they really just don't think a progressive can win there, so they don't. I have some disagreements with the DCCC on strategy and have, you know, aired those over the years. But the bottom line is that the progressives in the House of Representatives would have no place to stand if the rest of the Democrats weren't there. So, you know, we need to be all in on this.
Mm. Well, can I tell you another thing really fast?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. Voting. For many decades, I've been voting, and I've never had to show any kind of ID. How does that work in New York City, the biggest city in America?
Well, because when you first registered to vote, you demonstrated to the satisfaction of them that you lived there, presumably with something like, you know, I remember the first time I registered to vote in Michigan, I had to show a utility bill. Right? Demonstrate that you live there. I mean, they just assume if you show up and you talk normal English that you live here, that you were born here.
Yes, yes. But what I have is sign my name in the record book.
Of course.
So now every time I vote, all I do without ID, I just sign my name in the book at the polling site, and my signature matches the photocopy signature in the book.
Right.
And I never have to show any kind of ID.
Right, and this is you know, signing that document and saying, yes, this is my name, I'm the guy signing this. This is how we enforce contract law in the United States. I mean, if it's good for multinational corporations, why shouldn't it be good for voting? As you're absolutely right, it works just fine. Judy in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Hey, Judy, what's on your mind today? Oh, Judy is gone. Melody in Lamont, Florida. Hey, Melody, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I've been listening to the voter suppression stuff. And I was wondering, you know, Texas and Florida and all these that have to be monitored by the federal government for past bad action.
Right.
If Holder should go ahead and demonstrate that some of these suppression voter ID laws put out by the states are illegal, wouldn't that risk all the ALEC-sponsored legislation in those states eventually devolving to the same status as Texas and Florida?
It would. Here's the problem. Well, here's the risk. If Eric Holder brings a lawsuit against any particular state saying that, and for example, I mean, you've got Texas having this litigated right now in federal court, then eventually it's going to end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. And the U.S. Supreme Court gets to decide whether this is a violation of the 24th Amendment or some other part of the Constitution. Here's, by the way, this is Eric Holder, what he had to say today.
Many of those without IDs would have to travel great distances to get them. And some would struggle to pay for the documents they might need to obtain them. We call those poll taxes.
We call those poll taxes. See, and that's that was an ad-libbed comment, by the way. But if he does that, if and I'm guessing that this is going to end up before the Supreme Court. And if the Supreme Court continues to have a five-vote right-wing wackadoodle majority, then in all probability they will say, no, this isn't a poll tax. This is a reasonable requirement. On the other hand, I think that if President Obama is reelected and he appoints a cop, you know, and Justice Kennedy runs out of steam, he's quite elderly, and gets replaced by somebody else, that somebody else is appointed by the president, by President Obama, that there's a good chance that these will be declared a poll tax and in violation of the 24th Amendment. So we'll see, Melody. We'll see where this goes. But it is moving through that process right now.
Hey, friends, Tom Harmon here. Thanks a lot for the call. Thanks for watching and listening to the program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, it looks like the Republicans are getting their wish. Let's reduce all workers in America down to minimum wage. Scranton, Pennsylvania. The mayor there, Chris Doherty, says we're out of money. So we're going to pay the least we can by federal law, which is the minimum wage, $7.25 an hour, to our firefighters and our cops. And this has to be making people like Peter Ferrara, a senior fellow with the Carlson Center for Public Policy, theCCPP.org. Very happy. Peter, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here.
Are you not excited that firefighters and cops are only making $7.25 an hour?
I wrote a whole book arguing that I want all blue-collar workers to be millionaires. So read the book.
So how much do you think firefighters should be paid?
As much as possible.
And
I want them to be able to have personal savings and investment accounts that they could put what they're paying in payroll taxes in those accounts over a lifetime.
Uh-huh.
Average income to earn a couple of standard long-term market return would retire as millionaires.
So you oppose the efforts of Republicans in the House of Representatives and the Senate to block funding to the states. The Republicans successfully blocked this year and last funding to the states that would have prevented Scranton from going broke. You're opposed to these Republican efforts?
No, that's silly. I don't want responsible states and local governments to have to bail out irresponsible states and local governments. So we're not doing a Greek-style bailout. If Illinois can't manage its spending, or California, which is completely nuts, they have to deal with it. I don't want them to tax people in Texas and Florida and Indiana and other states where they're getting control of their...
So you think Scranton, Pennsylvania should raise their own damn taxes?
If they want the runaway spending, then they need to raise their own taxes.
So paying firefighters more than $7.25 an hour is runaway spending?
No. I want them to be paid as much as possible. Maybe they should be more responsible with their other spending.
Yeah. So Scranton should do what?
Scranton should cut their other spending and pay their firefighters and policemen more.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't look like they have the option of doing that. It looks like everything is broke. I mean, this is the disaster that the banksters brought us, and you know, with this horrible crash in 2008, and you don't think that we the people collectively should help out any of us who got caught by that?
No, I'm in favor of a robust safety net that will be better and more effective than what we have today. And the crash in 2008 was caused by the government, not by the so-called banksters. That was caused by government overregulation and by loose Federal Reserve monetary policy. So
then why is it from 1935 when Glass-Steagall was passed until 2000, we had no bank panics? At 2000 comes along, Phil Gramm pushes through Gramm-Leach-Bliley, which repeals Glass-Steagall. Suddenly you've got all these giant banks, and they can all gamble with your and my money. And they're starting to sell cities like Scranton, all these exploding forms of investments that you know, crashed with the market. We had never, from the founding of this republic until 1935, we'd never gone more than 15 years without a bank panic. We had no bank panics from 35 until 2007. You think that's because of regulations?
The repeal of Glass-Steagall eased the financial crisis of 2008 because it enabled commercial bank holding companies to buy failing investment banks. And
well,
so
it allowed monopolies.
Can I finish my point, please? Some firms that would have failed, in fact, survived because they were bought out by commercial bank holding companies. So it reduced the crisis.
So let me get this straight. When a city fails for whatever reason, they should simply fail, to hell with them. But when a bank fails, then a larger bank should be able to bail them out.
If the larger bank wants to bail them out, wants to buy them, that's up to the larger bank. That has nothing to do with the government or the taxpayers. I'm a Tea Party advocate. I'm opposed to any bailout of any bank or financial institution by the taxpayers, period.
Okay. I follow your logic. And then the end point of that logic is what happens when all the banks get bought up by one giant bank, and we're all bowing at the Bank of America.
Well, that's what you have the antitrust laws for. If you had one bank in the entire country, that would seem like a monopoly. But if you had it's government regulation that's forcing the closing of the smaller banks today and forcing the consolidation.
Well, we have six banks right now that are controlling assets that are equal to 65% of our GDP. You think that's healthy?
No, I don't think that's healthy. I think that that's due to excessive government regulation that's driving small banks out of business because they can't handle the cost as well as bigger banks. When the government imposes these costs, the bigger banks have more customers to spread it over, but the smaller banks do not. So they're driving them out of business.
God.
Moreover, nothing in the financial crisis of 2008 was caused by commercial banks engaging in securities business. They were not, because even with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, a commercial bank could not engage in IPOs or
well, the other half of it was what Phil Graham also brought us, because his wife Wendy was on the board of Enron, which was the Commodities Futures Modernization Act, which said that no longer do commodities have to be traded on public and transparent exchanges. They can now be traded in secret in these gray areas and these dark exchanges. And the pool of phony baloney money, these credit default swaps and whatnot, grew from zero in 1999 to $700 to $900 trillion.
Credit default swaps reduce risk because it allows some companies to sell their risk to others, and that's what that's all about. And that's why that was highly desirable. That was
they've been around forever. When you actually are a player in the market, if you're actually an airline who's going to use oil, or if you're actually an oil company that's producing oil, it makes perfect sense. I'm with you, Peter. But what the Commodity Futures Modernization Act did was two things. One, it said that you can reduce risk on things that aren't inherently risky, right? That aren't commodities. In other words, they can be traded. You can create derivatives on them. And two, there's no oversight over these things. And
they're transferring interest rate risk, things like and other forms of market risk, when they buy and sell it, or else they wouldn't buy and sell it.
And look how well that worked out for us. The banksters got off, like, you know, many of them are billionaires still to this day. And the rest of us, I mean, we've seen a $7 trillion loss of net worth in this country.
That was the fallout of the subprime mortgage crisis that was forced on us by Bill Clinton's overregulation and by the Fed's loose, weak, cheap dollar monetary policy, which further pumped up the housing bubble. That cheap dollar monetary policy was due to Bush and his poor Secretary of Treasury, and the bank overregulation, the looting of the banks that resulted from that overregulation, that was Bill Clinton. So the both parties share the responsibility for it.
You know, I'm not disagreeing with you that loose monetary policy had some role in this. Alan Greenspan and his libertarian philosophy really did wreak havoc on this nation.
Is hard money.
It was
not loose money.
It was the deregulation of the banks.
Libertarians are for
that
the
brought about this crash.
Libertarians are for the gold standard, so they are not for a loose monetary policy. And deregulation only eased the crisis. And
I don't think most libertarians understand the gold standard, Peter.
It was regulation forcing the banks to do the subprime mortgages to trash their traditional lending standards. And
that's not
what,
true.
Created the housing bubble.
That's simply not true.
You can read Gretchen Morgan.
You're talking about the Community Reinvestment Act. I know you guys use this all the time as a talking point.
The Community Reinvestment Act. That Community Reinvestment Act was passed under Carter. It was Clinton that vastly expanded the regulation that turned it into a weapon to actually loot the bank.
There were no laws forcing banks to loan to anybody. Any bank could turn anybody down for any reason except their race. And if they could find that person was not able to pay back the loan, that was plenty of reason to say no.
Have you ever heard disparate impact? disparate impact? Is it, you know, it's the impact of your policy? So if you turn down more low-income people or minorities than others, for whatever reason, it's a disparate impact. And they were
well, those are two different things. The banks could always turn down low-income people.
No. If it has a disparate impact racially, it was they were being sued by Janet Reno at the Justice Department. They were being sued by HUD. And they were looted as a result. And they all thought that they could survive.
Peter, I'm not buying it. We got robbed by the banks. Those rules are still in place. Peter Ferrara, theCCPP.org. Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. What are we going to do? $7.25 an hour to be a cop? You couldn't pay me that much to get shot.
Back in Texas, minimum wage is $5.15. Bend over for the federal standard, cause you're never getting paid any better in Texas. Minimum wage is $5.15.
I think it's gone up since that song was recorded. Welcome back. Jim in Worcester, Mass. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hi, you got a great show. I watch you every day if I can.
Thank you.
On TV. You know, this is the old divide and conquer. I have a couple of friends who work in a private sector, and all they do is complain about public employees. These guys only make $10 to $12 in the private sector. The rich have been using this trick for years.
Sure.
So these guys here, they're always complaining, oh, those guys, they're making too much money. And I try to explain to them that that's what you should be striving for.
Yeah.
You just can't get across.
Well, this is what Scott Walker said. He was talking to this woman who was a billionaire funder of his campaign, literally a billionaire and you know, a business owner. And she said, what are you going to do about these unions? You know, we got to get rid of these unions. I want to turn Wisconsin into a right-to-work state. It works to words to that effect. And he said, you know, we've got a plan for that. We're going to pit them against each other, public against private. It's the divide and conquer strategy. I mean, Scott Walker came right out and said it.
Yeah, and it works. It actually works.
Yeah, it does. If you say to the people who, you know, it used to be before Reagan, it used to be the government workers. And I'm quite familiar with this. One of my brothers has been a government worker for years and years and years. And before Reagan, government workers made less than people in the private sector. Public employees, government employees made less doing the same job. And they still do above a certain level, above, you know, with anything that requires a graduate degree, or higher, government workers make less.
I was one of those workers.
Yeah, okay. Government workers make less than private sector workers. But over time, what's happened is that the private sector has been so decimated by 30 years of Reaganomics and the destruction of our unions that now government workers have just been holding their head above water and everybody else is sinking below water. And the rich are coming along saying, hey, look at those guys who are holding their head above water. Grab their feet and pull them down. And yeah. You're right. It is working. Jim, thank you for the call. And, you know, very, very well said. Don in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Don, what's up?
Well, let me take a little bit different view on taxes here. I'm one of the evil rich people that are going to be affected by this if the tax cuts expire at the end of the year.
So you earn over $250,000 a year, personally.
Yes, sir. I own a trucking company that has 80 drivers, 14 administrative people, and 17 mechanics.
Okay, and your $250,000 a year that you're earning, your first $250,000 a year, is not going to be affected at all by letting the Bush tax cuts for the rich expire.
It's the marginal income at the other end.
You understand that. Okay, so you're telling me that you can't live on the first $250,000 a year, or that a 3% cut in the money that you're making after that first $250,000 is going to harm you?
No. I'm giving you a different take on the whole tax thing. I what I can live on or not isn't the issue here. If my company tax rate was cut by 10%, here's what could happen. I could hire 5 drivers, 1 mechanic, and 1 administrative person. I'd obviously have to buy the 5 trucks at about $120,000 per item, okay? And I'll sign a contract with the IRS to this effect. I will take none of that money personally. I'll use it to hire these people.
But what are you going to do, Don, when your taxes get cut and you can no longer hire people because they don't know how to read and write? Or what are you going to do when you're able to hire people, but you know you're in the trucking business and then the roads aren't being maintained?
Let me finish the example, okay? The federal government would end up making more tax revenue on the 7 people that I would hire that they'd be making on the tax cut that they gave me.
No, I'm familiar with the argument.
I wouldn't take a penny of that money because I'd be making money operating the trucks.
Sure. I understand the argument, but here's the question, Don. It's a very simple and straightforward one that you know is a much more fundamental issue than the level at which you're trying to argue this. And that is that if your corporation as a company is using the commons, every single business transaction you involve yourself in is either an explicit or an implicit contract. More than 50% of the cost of our court systems, more than 50% of the load on our court systems is corporate activity. If you're going to use the commons, whether it's our court system, whether it's educated workers, whether it's our roads, whether it's the standards that allow you to know that when you replace the calipers on the brakes on a truck that they really are what they say they are, if you're going to use any of those things in order to make your business successful, shouldn't you pay for those, or do you want me to pay for those?
No.
Because it sounds to me like you want me and your employees to pay for it. You want to be the freeloader, and you want all of us to pay the cost of supporting your ability to do business.
No, nice try. You're distorting totally what I'm saying. What I'm trying to say to you is, here's my choice. I can pay. I'm not arguing to say I should pay no taxes. I'm not making that argument at all.
You're arguing that your business should pay no taxes, and I'm saying your business is an entity that should pay.
No, I'm not arguing that at all. I'm not saying my business should pay no taxes. I'm saying that if the government would lower the taxes on my business, I could immediately hire the employees that I mentioned, put them to work, and the government would end up collecting more income tax revenue.
Don, I run a business right now. I've run businesses for 35 years. The only reason I have ever hired somebody, I've never hired somebody because I got a tax cut, and I've gotten a hell of a lot of tax cuts. The only reason I've ever hired somebody is because I needed them to meet consumer demand. Are you trying to tell me that you've got so much consumer demand that you need to hire 5 more people and you can't do it because of your taxes?
I'm telling you.
No, are you telling me that you've got so much consumer demand, so much demand for your products that you could genuinely hire new people right now?
I'm planning on hiring new people.
Oh, good. Go
You're
for it.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
These hypothetical, if only my taxes were lower, then I'd create jobs. Come on, give me a break. People hire people because they make them money. Judy in Mahwah, New Jersey. Hey, Judy, what's on your mind today?
Well, hello, hi. Listen, that man who was just on, if he thinks he has to hire new people out of profits, he should fire his accountant. I've had a small business, a micro business, really, for 32 years. And even I, bad businesswoman that I am, know that if I pay salaries, those are pre-tax expenses, not post-tax.
Yeah, they're tax-deductible expenses, actually.
Exactly.
If you want to reduce your taxes, hire some people.
Your payroll. And so this is the most bogus, dishonest argument, and they keep making it. So either they're the stupidest people in the world, or they don't mind lying.
No, it's a shill. The guy was a shill.
And if you say, well, I want to have the money up front, well, what's this risk reward thing we keep hearing about? Yeah, when I laid out money to pay someone before I had the results, the money that resulted, that was my risk.
Yeah.
But I would get the reward when I got paid. And that all comes out before taxes. And not enough people are challenging this.
Yeah.
We forget accounting 101.
Yeah.
And the same with Oh, excuse me. The same with the $250,000 cap. I believe they're talking about net taxable income, not gross.
Yes.
So if you're actually being taxed on $250,000 plus, you're making a lot more than that.
Yeah, and that was my point to him. And then he wanted to step off from that to try to make the argument that businesses shouldn't pay taxes or should pay less taxes. And it's a nonsense argument.
Keep telling people that because it's very important. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy. Margie in Mobile, Alabama. Hey, Margie, what's up?
I also want to respond to the truck company owner and some of my same points the person just made. He can hire those people right now. He won't pay tax on it.
Right.
If he needs to buy five trucks, guess what? Depreciable, he gets a tax deduction on depreciation.
Right.
The only thing he wants to do is shift any tax responsibility from himself to the working class.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought at first that he was trying to make some sense because he was saying, you know, if my corporate taxes were lower, I could hire additional people. And I'm like, well, but hiring additional people would lower your corporate taxes. But beyond that, that's not the reason why businesses hire people. I mean, you run a business, I run a business, you hire people because you have things that need to be done. And if those things that need to be done are going to produce profit for the business, then you're a successful business person. And if those things that need to be done don't produce profits for the business, ultimately you're an unsuccessful business person. And it's really simple, and it has almost nothing to do with taxes because taxes are only paid when you show a profit if you're a successful business person. So,
yeah,
thank you very much.
Like I said.
Go ahead.
Oh, like I said, all they're trying to do is come up with any type of excuse and lie to get out of their responsibility for their share of taxes and put their share of taxes on you and me.
Yeah, I agree. What I think is so funny is that there's, you know, there are actually these work from home ads, and there are people who make a living calling into talk shows and pretending to be somebody that they're not, or you know, making particular pitches that, you know, they're being paid to make. And it seems to me like a bad investment, because when somebody like that guy calls in, A, everybody figures out what's going on, and B, I get all these calls from people who want to refute him, like Frank in Philadelphia, who are anti-making his point. It seems like whatever that guy got paid for making that phone call, it was a bad deal. Frank, you're on the air.
Well, not to reiterate what you just said, I mean, the guy wants to hire five new truckers, but he gets a 10% tax break. Where does he get the work to generate for the five new truckers?
Right.
That's the bottom line. Nobody hires anybody in America, not even the Red Cross, unless they need them.
Right.
And
you only hire them if they can make you more money than they're going to cost you.
Right. Now I'll tell you how you can fix this whole problem, which is very easy. And it's an idea, okay? It's a blueprint that was craftily made in the 1800s and then again in the 1930s by the federal government under FDR by putting the people to a 40-hour work week.
Right.
Now, what we've done over the last 75 years plus is reduced the 40-hour, increased the 40-hour work week.
Right.
All right. People marched in the streets in 1892, okay, to demand an 8-hour day. With all this technology.
Actually, in 1892, they were marching to demand a 10-hour day, if my recollection is correct.
Well, they marched in the streets in New York, that's what created Labor Day, okay?
Right, but the 8-hour day came in the 1920s or 30s, didn't it? Wasn't it the 10-hour day that the progressives were fighting for in the 1890s?
Well, in 1892, they walked out of the Federal Labor Council in New York, okay,
right.
The Knights of Labor.
Right.
They walked out in the streets in 1892. In 1937, the federal government mandated a 40-hour work week.
Okay.
Henry Ford said he was working, his factory workers were working 10 hours a day in the 30s.
Right.
He said it's a pretty hard argument not to put on a 40-hour work week.
Yeah.
When my profits went from $40 million in 1 year to $60 million. Henry Ford was no good union guy, all right? But he even said, I'm a pig at the banquet, and some of this should be shared.
Mm.
I mean, we don't have that philosophy today, Tom.
Yeah.
And I'm a labor guy, but I am so sick and tired of hearing people like Rich Trumka say the same message that Lane Kirkland said, that Sweeney said. none of these guys really ever worked in the craft. They're closer to the one percenters than my membership is.
I'm not sure that that's true. I think in a lot of these unions, these guys came up from the bottom, Frank.
Rich Trunk of working in the mines when he's going to college on summer vacation, okay?
Rich Trunka, I'm sorry. You need to go back and read a biography of Richard Trunka because he was not the rich guy that you think he is. He worked his ass off. Robert in Walnut, California. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, can y'all hear me out?
I hear you fine.
Okay. I just had this a point, because, like, it seems to me that the Republicans, they have this, like, paradox philosophy. What it means is that, you know, like, they always want to twist the facts around. They never, even with my relatives, some of my father-in-law, when I talk to him, mm-hmm. he's a staunch Republican, and I tell him, you know, certain things about, Congressional Budget Office said that if the Bush tax cuts were cut off in 6 years, the debt would be solved in about 6 years if they just cut the Bush tax cut.
Yeah, but before Bush put into place his tax cuts, we were on par to have paid off the entire federal deficit within 10 years.
Yeah,
excuse me. There would be no deficit. And the Bush tax cuts are responsible for about a third of the annual deficit right now. Another third of it is our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and another third of it is the Bush Great Depression. You add all that together. Yeah, you're right. Thanks a lot for the call. John in Brooklyn. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How are you? Tom, my friend recommended a book to me from 1957. It won the Pulitzer Prize for history. It was called Banking and Politics in America by Bray Hammond. And I just actually finished it. I wanted to ask you, a lot of my friends were talking about conspiracy theories and things of this nature. And in this book, he talks about that after Andrew Jackson closed Nicholas Biddle, the second bank in the United States, within 10 years, the largest bank in the United States was August Belmont's bank in New York. And I didn't know who August Belmont was, so I looked him up. And it said within 1960 he was the president of the Democratic Party. And I'm like, oh, this is an interesting person. And it turns out he was actually a Rothschild agent. And I said to myself, wait a minute, these are just conspiracy theories. So I did a little more research, and I came across the Federal Reserve Act, and I came across who considered the father of the Federal Reserve Act, and it was Paul Warburg. And he was this German banker working for Kuhlow, once again a Rothschild
right.
agent.
John, so what's your point?
My point is, is there some type of international banking conspiracy, or why are all these Rothschild
agents
controlling?
Of course there is, but it's not the way that it gets laid out, particularly with the names that you're throwing out, is that, oh, there's an international Jewish banking conspiracy is usually how it gets phrased. I mean, that's the subtext of this stuff. And, because many of these names either are or sound Jewish. And that's not the case at all. Of course the international banksters, just like the international steel barons, just like the international pharmacy barons, just like the international food barons, just like the international petrochemical or fossil fuel barons, they know each other, they hang out together, they collude to their own benefit. Of course. It's not a good thing. I'm not in favor of it. I think that there needs to be strong and aggressive action to prevent these kind of cartels from forming. But how can you look at the pharmaceutical industry and see these giant cartels? See, one of these companies just a couple of weeks ago was hit with a $3 billion fine for illegally marketing one of their pharmaceuticals that they made over $10 billion on. So, gee, it's just a cost of doing business. To think that these drug companies are not, engaging in some sort of collusive activity would be a fantasy. To think that the oil companies, that Shell and ExxonMobil and BP, that they all don't know what each other is doing and they don't all work together at a certain level. I realize that there is a certain amount of arms length separation, but it's happening in every industry. And so, of course, it's happening in banking. And our challenge isn't to sit around and go, oh, my God, there's an international banking conspiracy. It's to point out that at every level, we're seeing a kleptocracy. We're seeing a new elite emerging, an oligarchy that is transnational and trans-industrial.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the remedy for that is the, you know, the exact opposite of what Ronald Reagan said. The remedy is government standing up and saying, no, we're going to stand for our people, not for the banksters. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 9.5 minutes, 10 minutes before the hour. And Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at Germany.info. Bob Ney is with us. Hey, Bob, welcome.
How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true of you.
I like the Edgar Winter song.
Oh, good. Well, thank you. So what's going on in the world today? By the way, let me lead the newscast here with a leading question. Eric Holder went off script today when he was speaking to the NAACP. He was talking about how people are going to have to pay to get IDs, and he said, this is a poll tax. Now, that was not part of his script. The 24th Amendment explicitly forbids poll taxes. In fact, it calls them poll taxes. So now that the Attorney General of the United States has said that many of these states that are following these ALEC proposed laws, the American Legislative and Council, or ALEC Council, founded by Paul Weyrich, the guy who back in 1980 said, I don't want everybody to vote. Our voting pot, you know, our leverage in the elections, quite frankly, goes up as the voting populace goes down. Now that the Attorney General has come out and said this is a poll tax, is the Justice Department going to follow up?
I think the Department of Justice has to follow up. I mean, you know, there's a panel of federal judges as we speak, and they're opening a trial in Washington, D.C. on this very topic.
On Texas.
Texas doesn't even accept student IDs.
Right, but they're not calling that. Is that Texas case being litigated around the 24th Amendment, around the issue of a poll tax, or is it being litigated around the civil rights laws suggesting that the way it's being done, it's discriminating against minorities? I believe it's the latter, isn't it?
Oh, it's the latter. But this whole ID issue, whether it's Texas, there's a case in Indiana, this is bubbling to the top. I think with the Attorney General making a statement that it, in his opinion as the Attorney General, that it's a poll tax, I would assume that the Justice Department is going to have to, you know, take a good hard look at all of this, of the civil rights aspect.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. You're on a lot of right wing radio shows. Are they all buzzing about this?
You know, ironically, no.
Huh.
I don't know why.
Yeah,
no, they're,
I'm surprised.
They're preoccupied with the tax.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tax on the rich.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. You know, how dare the President of the United States not extend tax cuts on millionaires and billionaires. After all, we're all millionaires and billionaires, right?
I mean, he came out with a very interesting proposal, and you know, is gulping a little bit of some, you know, his side of a philosophy of accepting some of the Bush tax cuts. It puts, in my opinion, Boehner in the House in a bind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see how they play this out. So what else is going on in the world today?
Well, a few things. The president's making a massive swing through some states, of course, and he has a spending edge. Although Romney raked in, I think it was $106 million, and of course, as you know, the money's flowing everywhere with the quote super PACs. TV in my home state of Ohio, when you turn it on, it's deafening with the ads. But I think that the president he's got a lot of enthusiasm that's out there, but this thing is just deadlocked. It's like a 47-47 deadlocked in the polls.
Yeah, and this deadlocked is before Karl Rove and the Chamber of Commerce have really dropped the big money bomb.
Exactly.
Which they're probably going to wait until about 4 weeks before the election. Isn't that typically, I mean, you've been through enough elections to know this, isn't that typically when, if you're going to squash the other candidate like a bug, you do it?
Yes, because Carl usually pulled out the gay marriage or the gun issue, you know, during the Bush years, but now he's got the money issue. Look, he's sitting on top of a massive, in my opinion, political fortune they've amassed, and I think he will hold it to the very end and try to come in and be the kingmaker with that super PAC.
Yeah. It's and is 501c4 as well.
Right, and those things, as you know, they're supposed to be in the public interest, et cetera.
Right.
Oh, come on, they're campaign tools.
Right. Is there? I know that the I think it's the DSCC and other groups are starting to loudly complain about this. Paul, one of the guys who works on our program, found a story from 2008 where a couple of progressive groups attacked Karl Rove's group of, you know, his 401c, 301c4, 401c4, for not, you know, operating in the public interest, for being basically a partisan hack. And, you know, Karl Rove attacked them back for being liberals who are just, you know, don't like the fact that they're losing. This has been around for a long time. Do you think there's any possibility that any of the donors to the Chambers Foundation or to Karl Rove's group are going to be exposed before the election?
No, I just don't think. It's held close to the vest. It can legally be held close to the vest. I listened to Rove on one of the radio shows where he said, well, we are in the public interest. We care about what happens to people to make a living.
Yeah.
You know, they've driven Mack trucks through this whole, you know, McCainian idea of campaign finance reform that really never happened.
Yeah. Okay.
Just didn't happen.
What else is up in the world?
Well, I'm calling it the week of fake Washington, because there's going to be, you know, there's going to be some votes. They're going to have a vote on quote Obamacare, which we know will pass the House, and it will go obviously nowhere in the Senate. The base has to be fed. So they'll have that. I seriously don't expect much more out of D.C. than they go to the August recess. They're in weak numbers anyway in the polling, the Congress as a whole. So it's not going to be a very productive week. It'll be more of amendments for show purposes, I would say. Romney is close in his Veep vice president selection, I believe, from what I hear up on the Hill. Very close.
And the odds seem to be over at Intrade on Rob Portman. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, I've known Rob forever. He's clean on a personal level, but he was Bush's trade rep. You know, the president's talking about outsourcing. Romney's talking about outsourcing. They're talking about our trade deficit, et cetera, et cetera. And Portman was George Bush's trade rep.
And we lost 50,000 factories during the Bush administration.
You've got it. And I just don't see where, of all the issues, if he was something else, head of EPA or whatever even, trade rep, I don't know.
Okay, Rob Portman is at 32% on Intrade. Tim Pawlenty is at 17.9%. He's number two. What do you think?
Well, I think Portman would get it before Pawlenty. Pawlenty, I don't even think will seek it.
Yeah, and then they've got Marco Rubio at 8.2%.
Well, he's out.
He's toast. Yeah,
yeah, he's
okay.
Not.
Oh, very interesting. Yeah. Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a few minutes. Should firefighters be making a minimum wage? And oh, actually, we covered that. Beyond that, how do we end unemployment in the United States?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. According to a recent Congressional Budget Office report, this is the nonpartisan, both Democrats, actually it's not even, they're nonpartisan. This is the agency that reports to Congress, right? It's part of the permanent federal bureaucracy, the Congressional Budget Office. According to a new report from them, President Obama's 2009 stimulus package saved in the neighborhood of 3 million jobs, preventing an all-out economic catastrophe. That's the good news. Bad news? Ever since then, Republicans have blocked every single stimulus measure, radically slowing down our nation's economic recovery. This is Mitch McConnell's Make Obama a One-Term President strategy. Republicans are even trying to make things worse by pushing for austerity and spending cuts, which of course means job cuts. And Republican governors have laid off more than 600,000 public workers around the nation. The result? Persistently high unemployment, and Americans of all stripes calling for more job creation. But here's the thing. We all have it wrong. It's not jobs we should talk about. It's hours on the job. Here's what I mean. Look at the average number of hours worked by each of the OECD nations. And what you'll discover is that the people who work the most are in Greece, where workers on average put in more than 2,000 hours a year on the job. That kind of blows up that old storyline that the Greeks are in an economic disaster right now because they're lazy. They actually work harder than any other country in Europe. They're an economic disaster because they turned to Goldman Sachs when they wanted to join the EU. But also near the top of the list of people who are working themselves to death is the United States at nearly 1,800 hours a year on average. Now, toward the bottom of the list are Germany and France, places where workers put in far fewer hours on the job each year. In fact, in Germany, which is doing just fine, thank you very much. In fact, they're basically bailing out Greece after Goldman Sachs ripped them off. In Germany, the average worker is on the job 20% fewer hours than in the United States. They work one-fifth as many hours as Americans. That comes to 400 more hours of time off for a German worker every year compared to a worker here in the United States. Now, you know, some people might argue that's a bad thing. Oh, yeah, Germany isn't working as hard as the United States. They should be suffering economically for it. Sorry, it's not the case. Germany and the United States were both hammered by the global economic downturn beginning in 2007. But where the U.S. saw our unemployment rate shoot up 4 percentage points since the recession, things got worse here. Germany actually saw their unemployment rate go down 2 percentage points. Things got better in Germany. That's because Germany and other nations that commit their workers to shorter work weeks understands something our media won't even talk about. It's that when people work fewer hours, then companies have to hire more people. And our media companies don't want to be talking about this. As economist Dean Baker at the Center for Economic and Policy Research wrote, quote, there is nothing natural about the length of the average work week or work year, and there are, in fact, large variations across countries. The average worker in Germany and the Netherlands puts in 20% fewer hours in a year than the average worker in the United States. That means that if the U.S. adopted Germany's work patterns tomorrow, it would immediately eliminate unemployment in the United States. Think about it. If a company employing 5 people, each working 40 hours a week, cut their work hours down to 35 a week, then they'd have to hire one new person to make up for the lost 25 hours. Of course, there's a counter-argument to this. That's, those people were working 40 hours, now they're working 35. Aren't they going to take home less money? And B, companies are going to get hit with extra hiring costs because they have to hire and train new employees. Germany found a solution to the first problem with their Kurzarbeit, or short week program. During the recession, Germany told businesses not to lay off workers but to cut back on their hours. Then the government stepped in and subsidized those who were working fewer hours, essentially paying them for a 40-hour work week, even though they were only working 25 to 35 hours. That's why Germany's economy never really crashed. Working people stayed on the job, and we're still collecting their full salaries to go out and spend and create demand, demand being that thing that drives economies. Which is, by the way, the answer to the second problem. What do businesses do to handle the cost of having to hire new employees? Simple answer is that those new costs would be offset by more demand in the economy, thus more revenue for businesses. The United States currently has nearly 15 million people unemployed or underemployed. If work hours were cut back, creating new job openings for these millions of unemployed Americans, then they'd all have more money in their pockets to spend and stimulate the economy. People would be earning salaries again. Businesses would be making money again. The economy would be growing. Everybody would win. You know, it's pretty straightforward stuff. If the economy was just rip-roaring along, if somebody came along to me, we have a staff of it's more than that. There are 3 people working here in addition to me right here in this office. And then Sean is working full time out of Portland. Louise is working full time on this show. Nigel is working part time. Sue is working pretty much full time on this. So we've got a bunch of people working on our show. If the government came along and said, okay, you've got to hire one more person. I mean, right now we're just kind of, we're doing okay. But it would cost us money. But if they said that to everybody in the country, then there would be more money in the economy because more people would have money in their pocket. Unemployment levels would go down, which means that wages would go up. And there would be more competition for those dollars, which means that there would be more people advertising on our radio show and being willing to pay more for the ads because there's a finite amount of ad space out there, which means that our little business of this radio show would make more money so we could pay for that extra employee. You see how this works? Now, I'm not just blowing this out of the top of my head here. it's actually been tried. Back in 2000, France tried it. They introduced a 35-hour-a-week limit. Companies that had people work more than 35 hours got hit with penalties, or they lost the ability to deduct the cost of those employees. And so all across France, companies cut their employees back to 35 hours, and the same amount of work had to be done, so they had to hire more people. And as the Financial Times reports, it was a great success. Quoting the Financial Times, as the French government statistic agency known as INSEE estimated, the shorter week, quote, created between 300 and 350,000 jobs in the initial years, while productivity increased 4 to 5%, end quote. Not only that, worker pay in France increased as well, putting the nation up on par with Germany's average worker pay. Germany has the highest in Europe. And their average workers work one-fifth less than the average American. Despite the success in France, by the way, that 35-hour work week was ditched by the right-wing government of Nicolas Sarkozy a few years back, and he was George Bush light. And sure enough, guess what went up? Unemployment. Now that France is in economic turmoil because of Sarkozy, the people have elected a new socialist president to get it back on track, and he's promised to both lower the retirement age down to 60, which would open up more jobs, and to cut back on the work week. Both of these things will open many, many more jobs and thus reduce the unemployment rate. Frankly, that is much different from the American experience. Back in the 60s, when unemployment wasn't an issue, the average husband-wife family with children worked 53 hours a week between the two of them. But after Reaganomics, by 2002, that number had exploded to 64 hours a week, 67 hours a week for families without kids. The point of all this is pretty simple. Let's learn basic economics from the successes of other times in America and other nations. Why not try what some European nations have tried with tremendous success? Cut short the work week. Not only will that eliminate our unemployment problem, but it will also give Americans more time to spend with their family and friends, and more time to pursue hobbies and leisure activities, and more vacations, and even more time to make inventions and be creative. Who could possibly be opposed to that? So, yeah, this is not one of the ones that I suggested in my book, Rebooting the American Dream. The other one that I did, which is the other half of this, is drop the retirement age by 5 years.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
These are simple government policies that actually would reduce unemployment to zero, which seems to me like something the government should be doing.
Well, they closed down the auto plant in Mahwah late last month. Ralph went out looking for a job, but he couldn't find none. He came home too drunk from mixing Tanqueray and wine. He got a gunshot a night clerk, now they call him Johnny 99.
I used to listen to Johnny Cash. I could listen to Johnny Cash all day long. This is what happens when you're 17 years old and your first serious real job is as a country western DJ. I'll tell you, I went into WITL thinking, I'm going to hate this music, but it's a job, you know, $2.35 an hour. Holy cow. And I discovered that there's some pretty good music in there. Okay, you have probably seen screaming at the top of Drudge Report if you inflict that upon yourself, or any other right-wing website or Fox News or anybody else. 83% of American doctors are going to quit their practices because of Obamacare. Seen that? I have repeatedly seen this meme. Of course, I read the news for a living. It's all over the place. I mean, the right-wing blogosphere, I've got all the emails, all the viral emails. Every Tea Partier is repeating this thing everywhere. And it's coming from the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. Now, you may remember that I debated, I believe it was the president of the association, it was one of the officers. It's this basically a small group of right-wing cranks who think that vaccinations are bad for you. This guy was a dentist down in Florida that I debated. It was like a year and a half ago. And he was on saying that we should not have any national health care programs. We shouldn't have Medicare. We shouldn't have Medicaid. It's all socialism. This is a group that thinks vaccines are a socialist conspiracy. It's part of the plan of the government to enslave us all and eventually lead to a Stalinist or a Nazi state. This is the group that put out the argument that it was illegal immigrants who are bringing leprosy to the United States. Actually, it's armadillos. Don't tell them. So, oh, and they were promoting the idea that Vince Foster was murdered by Hillary Clinton. So they did a survey of their members, and the headline over at Drudge and every place else was 83% of doctors say Obamacare is causing them to think about quitting medicine, or words to that effect. Here's the actual survey to their right-wing wackadoodle members, all, what, 25 of them maybe? How do current changes in the medical system affect your desire to practice medicine? Current changes? You mean things like the Paul Ryan budget turning Medicare into a voucher system? We don't know, because they didn't say. They never mentioned Obamacare. They didn't mention the Affordable Care Act. They simply said current changes. I'm re-energized, 4.6%. Makes me think about quitting, 82.6%. Unsure, no opinion, 12%. Right. This is, by the way, you want to read a really good dissection of this thing. It's over at MediaMatters.org. It is really quite remarkable. So, you know, anyhow, back to the economics issue. I think, frankly, we need to seriously be looking at ways to put people back to work, to have full employment in the United States. There are a couple of obvious things. Number one, the Fed was chartered in 1913 to do two things. Regulate interest rates, in other words, prevent inflation, keep inflation below 3%, and keep unemployment low. Keep unemployment below, I believe, 4% is the target that's set for them. Now, they've got interest rates really, really low, but unemployment? Why aren't they paying attention to that? Well, because Alan Greenspan never thought that counted. The Fed hasn't seriously looked at unemployment since the Greenspan era. It should be, but it doesn't. Okay, so that's one. Second, you want to reduce unemployment? Cut back the work week from 40 hours to 35 hours. Or reduce the age at which people are eligible for Social Security benefits and Medicare from 65 to 60. And not everybody's going to say, who's 60 years old or over, is going to say, hey, I think I'll quit my job today. But a significant number will, and there's a lot of, I mean, this is the boomers, right? There's a lot of those people who are going to say, okay, I'm out of here. I'll take the Social Security. And what's that going to do? It's going to open up all these jobs for young people who can't find jobs coming out of college. Unemployment goes to zero. Wages go up. What goes up along with wages? Tax collections. The government has enough money. Suddenly the deficit doesn't exist anymore. Everything's good. I mean, people point out, and I'm one of them, that when Bill Clinton raised the top marginal tax rate by 3%, he ended up with not only a balanced budget, and maybe, Shane, you can find this clip of George W. Bush saying that, you know, in his first State of the Union address, that he's going to pay off the entire national debt in the next decade. I mean, that was the kind of surplus that Bill Clinton left us. Now, part of it was because he raised taxes. Now, part of it was that, you know, there was this explosion going on in the tech industry, which was partly bubble and partly not. I mean, there really were radical changes. I mean, look at Apple. Look at Microsoft. But the fact of the matter is that had we not... You got it, Jim? Okay, let's play it. Here's George W. Bush.
Many of you have talked about the need to pay down our national debt. I listened, and I agree. We owe it to our children and grandchildren to act now. And I hope you will join me to pay down $2 trillion in debt during the next 10 years. At the end of those 10 years, we'll have paid down all the debt that is available to retire. That is more debt repaid more quickly than has ever been repaid by any nation at any time in history.
Now, you know, he changed that by coming up with two wars that were unfunded, a Medicare Part D that was unfunded, and most importantly, a gigantic tax cut for millionaires and billionaires that was unfunded. And so instead of paying off the debt, he jacked the debt up. I mean, you know, he made that speech and everybody applauded. And then somebody took him off to the side and said, let me tell you about Judah Wininsky and two Santa Clauses. because you're making a big mistake, George. You're a Republican. You're in the White House. When Republicans are in the White House, you're supposed to run up the national debt, not pay it off. It's the new rules since Reagan. But it is possible, I think, for us to pay it off. And
you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And have full employment. I mean, we were in that position in 2000. We were the peace dividend. We were ready to pay off the debt, and everybody could work. Yep, that would be the good, the bad, and the very, very mucilaginously ugly, the good. The Cork, Ireland City Council. Last night, the Cork City Council became the first local authority in Ireland to officially support marriage equality. The council unanimously passed a motion to support it. Michael Nugent, a member of Ireland's Sinn Féin party and a council member, said that marriage equality is, quote, an essential part of an equality agenda, end quote. He also said, quote, the struggle is ongoing for recognition and equality in society. I hope this is a step in that struggle, end quote. A similar motion was passed across the border in Belfast, Northern Ireland, last week as well. Government officials across the pond are accepting marriage equality. It's about time those in Washington and across America did the same thing. The bad. Matt Drudge. Drudge, the founder of the infamous conservative news site The Drudge Report, is no stranger to promoting far-right conspiracy theories. But now he's thrown his support behind a truly absurd conspiracy theory that says President Obama was once a secret agent for the CIA in Pakistan. The original secret agent Obama story, published on the birther website WorldNet Daily, argues that the president might have been a CIA agent during his time at Columbia University and spent time in Pakistan. Just what Americans need, another crazy conspiracy theory to waste time arguing about when we should be talking about the issues that actually matter, like the robotic pigeons in the planet Xenu. And the very, very ugly Congressman David Dreyer, California. Last night during a House Rules Committee debate, Republican Dreyer said he didn't think that people with pre-existing conditions should be able to get health insurance. In fact, he said, so you got a brain tumor, it doesn't mean you should be able to get millions of dollars worth of health care. Dreyer's not alone in his comments. Many Republicans in Washington have said that insurance companies shouldn't have to cover those with pre-existing conditions like brain cancer. Basically, Dreyer and his colleagues don't want sick Americans to be able to get the health care they need to survive, and that is very, very ugly. No other way to describe it. Mind-bogglingly ugly. It's incredible. Oh, my. Gary in Surprise, Arizona. Hey, Gary, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Oh, I made a comment. When I got my job at Kaiser Aluminum in the 60s,
mm-hmm.
I was hired and told I was hired because the steelworkers negotiated 10-week vacations every 5 years for all of us steelworkers.
Right.
And so I got my job, and there were, I'm going to guess because I can't remember exactly, but about 20 people per period divided into 10 weeks. I can't remember exactly, but there were like four right. segments a year.
So you were hired as the guy who fills in when all these guys got the vacations that they negotiated.
Yes.
So you're making the argument that by reducing our work hours, whether we were to dial back from a 40-hour week to a 35-hour week, or whether, obviously with a small company it would be really difficult, but with a larger company where you've got enough of a workforce that there could be some load balancing, that if we were instead to go from basically the average of a week and a half vacation that Americans take that up to the 4 weeks that are, I believe, are legally required in most European countries, 6 weeks in Germany, that if we did that, that also would increase the workforce, it would reduce unemployment, and in fact, you have a job as a consequence of that sort of a policy.
Yeah, and that was the entire steel workers, so that was all the steel plants, and aluminum plants, and all the plants
right.
that the steel workers covered. So what's that, 100, 2,000, 5,000 jobs?
Yeah, it's significant.
By this one, and guess what? It all went away in the 80s.
Yeah, well, my wife says that my tombstone is going to say it all started with Reagan. Thank you, Gary, for the call. In fact, I've got the website. It all began with Reagan.com, and it all started with Reagan.com. And someday I'm going to do something with those websites, I'll tell you. Mike in Indianapolis. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I really appreciate the dialogue you open up for America and everything.
Thank you.
Wanted to just touch upon, as you mentioned, how do we end unemployment? Well, don't have all the answers. Obviously, I wish I did. But one step I think that could be taken is obviously a perspective of the so-called don't tax the job creators, where their mindset obviously is on save money by not hiring people. I can't remember who it was about a month ago or so. He was actually a multi-million-dollar entrepreneur, so the last thing CEOs want to do is hire anybody. But the focus is almost placed upon let's save money by not hiring people so we can sell our product versus let's make a better product and remove the distraction of how much money we save by not hiring people versus hiring people to make a better product and thus making a product that sells itself and base your competition and base your sales and off of stuff that you actually sell. I mean, America doesn't seem to make anything anymore.
No, I agree with you. And in fact, your very last sentence was the point that I was going to speak to. You know about the dark star theory, the dark planet theory, the way that they astronomers and astrophysicists discover that, hey, there must be a star there even though we can't see it, or a black hole because things around it get distorted. The thing that is distorting the employment picture in the United States is that our trade policies have changed in the last 30 years. And our trade policies have changed in such a way that you're right, we don't make things here anymore. And so many of these solutions, including solutions like President Obama pursued in 2009, which was, okay, let's inject some money into the economy. First generation jobs, we'll hire people to do infrastructure projects, for example. Well, those people then, they spend their money at the local restaurant, second generation jobs at the local store. But then that third generation job is the restaurant is buying the food from Argentina and Brazil, or the local store is buying their stuff. You know, if it's Staples, they're buying their stuff from China. So and then poof, that's the end of the stimulus. Whereas
right,
it used
to. If you inflate any portion of that any part of those steps, if you make one area bigger than the other, that actually obstructs or screws up that whole momentum. You basically, stick the wrench in the gear.
Yeah, you're distorting the system, and that's why we really need a systemic approach. It's not, Mike, thanks for the call. It's not like we don't know how to do this. We did this before. You have a rational trade policy that protects, a protectionist trade policy that protects your workers and your manufacturers. We had that from 1791, actually. It was proposed in 1789 by Alexander Hamilton, signed into law by George Washington in 1791. We had that from 1791 until the 1980s, 90s, and 2000s, until that era, that 30-year era, when we all started drinking Thomas Friedman's Kool-Aid and saying, oh, the world is flat. Isn't that cool? It's nonsense. The world is not flat. I mean, it's self-evidently, so number one, we've got an insane trade policy. Number two, the government should be the employer of last resort. This is what Franklin Roosevelt proved. If you put people to work building, and there's always stuff that needs to be done in this country, right? We can always reclaim wetlands. We can always, restore forests. I mean, that was one of the big things the CCC did. We had these horrible dust bowl storms across the United States because we had deforested so much of the Midwest, and there was no trees to hold the soil. So he put, Franklin Roosevelt put hundreds of thousands of people to work planting trees. Those trees are today's forests in many parts of this country. So there's always things to do. Government should be the employer of last resort, number two. And number three, regulate the number. You control access to the workplace by regulating the number of hours that people work. And you can do that with vacation policies. You can do that with wage policies. You can do that with maximum hour policies. There's a variety of ways to do that. Mark in San Francisco. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I think the best idea is to drop the age of Social Security down to 55, take the cap off, and make it voluntary.
Yeah, that was my suggestion in rebooting the American Dream. And
I think that's absolutely the best, because you're also going to stimulate the economy by having more money go into it.
Yeah, Because all these, you're going to have all these new people coming into the workforce. You're going to create a lot of new jobs. You're going to create a lot of new demand because they're going to have money in their pockets. Rather than living with mom and dad, they're going to be out there in the workforce. There's going to be a demand for housing. There's going to be a demand for everything. It would be a boom like there was no tomorrow. And instead, what we've got is, because of the 30 years of Reaganomics, you've got people in their 60s and in their 70s. And in some cases, in their 80s, who are staying in the workforce, showing up and you know, working at Walmart and whatnot, when really they shouldn't be. They should be retired. We should. You're absolutely right, Mark. Very, very well said. Thank you for the call, Todd in Ridgeland, Mississippi. Hey, Todd. A minute to the break. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I think everybody missed the point on the guy with the five trucks that could hire five more drivers and buy five new trucks.
Right.
Because of the tax breaks. He might have been able to do that, but the government could have hired 20 new people to build roads, and we could have had an infrastructure going, and we could have been making 20 other people more money instead of just one.
Yeah. Well, and you know, he missed a lot of points, and one of the disadvantages of spending, you know, 10, 12 hours a day doing show prep every day and being on the air as well, is that I don't get to listen to a lot of other shows, and we've had. Paul came in during the break, the last break. Paul was answering the phone right now and said, we've just been slammed with callers saying, you know, that guy with the trucking story, he calls into other shows and he's got these phony baloney stories. And, you know, so he's a paid caller. But Todd, you're right. The point is well taken. And here's the biggest point. The only reason anybody hires somebody is because they have to. They have to because they have demand. If you have to because your business is growing and you have demand, that's a good thing. But you hire people because you have to, and they make you more money. That's why it happens. It's demand, not supply.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we the people, this marvelous invention of the Founding Fathers, we the people have the ability to influence that with government policy. Indeed it is. Welcome back, James in Seattle. Hey, James, what's on your mind? Thanks for listening to Talk 1090.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you, James?
Very good, sir.
Thank you.
I want to get to tell you how Ronald Reagan got the idea of stamping out unions.
Okay.
He used to come to Singapore in the 70s. He was close friends with Lee Kuan Yew.
Okay.
He used to travel there all the time. And Lee Kuan Yew stamped out the unions in Singapore. Now, this was all Milton Friedman's idea. Milton Friedman came to Singapore and spent a lot of time there. And because of him, Singapore became the country it is now.
Yeah.
But
it may be, but, you know, Reagan was also, Margaret Thatcher came to power in the UK 2 years before Reagan was elected. She was elected in 78. And the first thing that she did was crush the coal unions, and they were the largest unions in the country. And she just basically took them on and squashed them like a bug. And so when Reagan came into office, he felt like the first thing he had to do was go after a union that was standing up to him, PATCO, which the Professional Air Traffic Controllers Organization, which had supported him in the election because his campaign had told them that if they supported him in the election, he would not contest their demand that the FAA modernize the equipment in the control towers. And
you're absolutely correct.
So,
now,
you know,
what he did was in the mid-70s, he squashed Singapore Airlines pilot union.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. He stood up to Lee Kuan Yew.
So this was happening all over the world. You're right, James. Excellent point. It was happening all over the world. What we're seeing is the rise of these elites crushing average working people. Nancy in Sanford, Florida. Hey, Nancy, what's up?
Oh, my God. I've been dying forever to talk to somebody about this.
Okay.
My husband, bless his heart, bought me a Sirius radio for my birthday that I can listen to in the house because I do not talk on cell phones while I drive.
Okay.
You talked to somebody from the PPCC. I don't know what that is. I don't know who the gentleman you were talking about.
Peter Farrar, the Carlson Center on Public Policy. Yes.
Yes. Well,
it's a conservative think tank.
Yes, and they're so proud to be conservative. why doesn't, like, maybe you've done it and I have missed it, why doesn't somebody ask these people, if you lost your job today, are you set for life? Do you have enough money put away that you can live the rest of your life? Have you made arrangements with a doctor to take care of you for free for the rest of your life? I mean, there've got to be some poor Republicans somewhere in this country.
You would think. Here's the problem. These guys are ideologues. They preface every, not just every sentence, but every thought with the phrase, if only everybody would. Right? They have this perfect world that Ayn Rand laid out for them and Atlas Shrugged, where the job creators went on strike. John Galt led the strike. And as a result of that, the world fell apart, or the country fell apart, because the billionaires went on strike. It's a stupid notion, I know. And, you know, Ayn Rand was not the brightest bulb on the tree, and Atlas Shrugged is a pretty bad book. But there's a lot of these people who actually believe this stuff and proudly call themselves libertarians, and they wouldn't have a pot to pee in if they lost their job. They would die if they got sick. They'd have to beg for public, you know, help. Ayn Rand herself, when she, toward the end of her life, she got on, you know, when she turned 65, she signed up for Medicare and Social Security. She took them both. And when she got lung cancer from a lifetime of smoking cigarettes, her cancer therapy was paid for by Medicare. Ayn Rand. You know, hypocrisy knows no bounds, answer one. And answer two, true ideologues don't care about the real world. They believe in this fantasy world that they've constructed. But, Nancy, your point is brilliantly made. Thank you very much for calling and making it. Travis in Washington, D.C. Hey, Travis, what's on your mind today?
How's it going, big guy? Long-time listener, first caller, I guess you can say.
Okay. Thank you.
Love you on Bill Maher. Loved you on Bill Maher.
Thank you.
I'm a big time gamer dork and I'm a liberal, but I wanted to call in. George Lucas written the Star Wars universe,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going with this pretty quickly, but there's a new game that came out recently and the bad guys in this is sort of almost modeled after Benito Mussolini's fascist regime where these lords control these planets and they control everything and they control the production. They control every little bit and they're unaccountable for their actions.
Right.
So they'll poison a planet and make it completely sick and the local population's dying and they just don't give a damn. They're like, we made more money. And
right.
It's kind of weird. Don't you kind of see us kind of going that direction? George Lucas hinted that in his movies.
Yeah.
Where the Republic died from within by embracing fascism, they sacrificing, you know, freedoms for security. And mm-hmm. I kind of see that going on in the United States. I'm pretty sure you wrote on that in the past. I just wanted to make that comment.
No, it's an excellent point, Travis, and thanks for sharing it with us. I didn't know about that game, but you're right on. Patrick in Los Angeles. Hey, Patrick. Thanks for listening on our iPhone app. So what's up?
Hey there, Tom. Love your stuff. Great show. Although I don't get to listen too much because, you know, I'm out in L.A. and I'm working during the day. But, you know, you know, we constantly hear about the knuckle-draggers talking about how, you know, government does everything badly. You know, the government shouldn't be trusted with employing people. And as you mentioned, you know, government should be the employer of last resort. But no liberal talker or candidate or whatever should ever concede that point. Ever, ever, ever. Because the appropriate response is, no, it's not government. It's conservative government. And really, you know, anybody can come up with, well, I don't know if anybody, but you know, it's easy to come up with several examples. Here in California back in 2001, we had the whole FERC deal with the energy crisis that occurred when the blackouts were happening and the, you know, rates were skyrocketing. We never got protected because the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission was filled up with Enron and Duke.
You're absolutely right. Patrick, we're out of time. I'm sorry, but you made an excellent point. Coming up tomorrow, you've heard a lot about the Buffett rule. Have you heard about this? The UN is calling for a global billionaires tax. Yeah, we're going to have an interesting debate on that. And don't forget, democracy begins when you participate. It's not a spectator sport. You got to get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. Occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.